Welcome to the Moen Broadcast Center. This is Take Two. Me, Martinez. Apple puts its money where its mouth is. Silicon Valley tech giant is pledging $2.5 billion to address affordable housing in the state. But hey, it's California, so how far can that dough really go? Plus, for many people, getting a pair of sneakers is about putting shoes on feet. For others, it's about art and style with a heavy dose of cultural and social relevance. That's ahead on Take Two. Stay with us. From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I'm Martinez. Thanks for choosing us to start your work week. All right, coming up, we check in on LA's experiment with electric scooters. There's some good news and some bad news. We're going to talk to the Department of Transportation about the pilot program that's been going on for about 6 months now in the city. Plus, we're going to head over to Sneakertopia. That's a pop-up art exhibit devoted to sneaker culture in LA and beyond.
This one pair, this is a $25,000 pair of sneakers.
Wow. I got to see it right there, right in front of my face. Never got to put it on, though. And there's so much more to grab your attention, so please stay tuned for that toward the end of the show. First, though, Apple this morning pledged $2.5 billion to help combat the affordable housing crisis in California. This follows similar moves by other tech giants. Google and Facebook have each committed $1 billion to the cause. For more, let's talk to Rachel Miro, Senior Editor, Silicon Valley News Desk, KQED. Rachel, welcome.
Glad to be here.
Now, Apple is making this pledge. Let's start by just looking at what the money is for. What's it supposed to go toward?
$2.5 billion in aid. Let me break it down for you. $1 billion for affordable housing investment. $1 billion to help first-time homebuyers get into mortgages. Basically a mortgage assistance fund. $300 million worth of land Apple owns in San Jose, which would be made available for affordable housing. $150 million for a Bay Area housing fund consisting of long-term forgivable loans. And finally, $50 million to support vulnerable people, which is to say homeless people, by providing that money to Destination Home, which is a local nonprofit that helps address the issue in Silicon Valley.
All right, so that's the cash. How will it be managed? What agency or body will oversee how the money is going to be spent?
That's where there's a little less clarity. And this is true for most of the housing proposals put forward by tech titans like Apple, Facebook, and Google. They say they're going to be doing it in conjunction with local governments, also the state government, also some of these nonprofits like Destination Home.
Will the state of California have much of a say in it?
Yes. Apparently, they've been involved in the negotiations, which is what leads me to guess that this has been going on for some time, that Apple didn't just decide to lay this housing plan on us out of the blue.
Now, Apple now joins the ranks of other multi-billion dollar companies that have pitched in to help create more affordable housing. Facebook has chipped in. Google has chipped in. Why are companies doing this?
Well, you know, I think the public conversation has changed in recent years. It used to be that tech titans said, gosh, you know, we make widgets, we write software. It's the job of the local communities that we exist in to figure out the housing piece of things. But we've reached a point where the jobs housing imbalance in the Bay Area is so bad that it's literally dysfunctional. We have so many people who have been displaced from the local housing market, some of whom still work here, but drive in crazy distances, like from Sacramento or Manteca in the Central Valley, just to work here. It's out of control. It's a situation where something needs to be done and done soon. And these companies are in a position to help, either because they have land, you know, properties that could be made available, and because they have cash.
Now, to that point, though, many housing watchers are quick to point out that Apple has stood on the sidelines for this for quite a while. They've been in Silicon Valley a long time. So what do you think made them make this pledge now?
I think there is that sense that, you know, we're reaching critical mass. When you watch other major companies like Google and Facebook come forward with their plans, I think that increases the pressure on a company like Apple to change its ways, to be seen as sympathetic to and responsive to local communities that are struggling right now.
Now, Silicon Valley, one of the wealthiest areas in the country, San Francisco, one of the most expensive cities to live, raise a family. Who are housing advocates hoping that this benefits the most? And actually, how far can $2.5 billion bucks really go in California?
Well, sad to say, in the Bay Area's housing market, a few billion here and there isn't going to move the needle very much. But it is a powerful symbolic gesture on the part of all of these companies. And I think the folks that many of us here in the Bay Area are most worried about would be the missing middle, the people who are essential for a community to function well. You think school teachers, police officers, even the folks who might be serving up your latte or building your new kitchen remodel, all of the folks who make less than $100,000 a year, they and their families are critical to the well-being of the Bay Area. And I suspect that that's where a lot of this money is going to be targeted at, in the hopes of, helping people stay in the Bay Area and continue to contribute to the community.
We're talking to Rachel Miro, senior editor of Silicon Valley News Desk, KQED. Now, this idea of corporate citizenship has really only taken root in the last few years. What do you think is behind the push to get tech companies and private investors to do more to support the communities around them?
I think we've reached a point here in Silicon Valley where we're not just congested. Things are dysfunctional right now. We're not working for a whole lot of people here. The traffic is out of control. It's like L.A., actually. And I can say that because I'm from L.A., so I know what bad traffic looks like, and we've hit bad traffic. I think people who are in a position of power because of their land holdings, because of their wealth, because of their ability to influence the public discussion, find themselves in a position they weren't in just 5 years ago, where there is a public expectation that they do more to help at least soften the edges of the housing crisis that, frankly, they helped to create.
Now, is private investment necessary, do you think, and why?
Well, it's hard for a reporter to opine,
but
I will say that when you're looking at something of the magnitude and the urgency of the housing crisis we're in right now, we seem to need a whole bunch of solutions. There's not going to be one silver bullet. So whether it's, a granny flat in the backyard, or it's a housing complex funded largely by a tech titan, each different answer to the housing crisis is welcome right now.
All right, Rachel, one more thing. We mentioned how Apple will work in partnership with the state of California, with Governor Gavin Newsom. Now, he's faced criticism over the way he's handled the state's housing crunch. He was also elected with some support from Silicon Valley. So is this a way Newsom can continue to be a friend to tech, but also say that he's helping with the solution to housing woes?
Well, yeah, you have to think about the fact that some bills have passed his desk. Some bills never made it to his desk that were designed to address the housing crisis. He's under a great deal of public pressure, like Apple, to show that he's moving the ball forward in some form or fashion. One thing is for sure, when Apple says it wants to spend money, there's nobody who's going to say, no, don't do that, versus some of the bills we've seen, like SB 50 in Sacramento, have gotten a lot of blowback, both in front of the cameras and behind the scenes, from everybody from, local politicians to local homeowners here who don't want to see that kind of regulation roll forward.
That's Rachel Miro, senior editor, Silicon Valley News Desk, KQED. Rachel, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Okay, so do you want an outside-the-box solution to California's housing crisis? Well, think Legos. Really, really big Legos. Some California companies believe they can build apartment buildings cheaper and faster by assembling them in a factory and stacking them on site. One factory-made building in Oakland took just 10 days to put up, start to finish. As part of our California Dream collaboration, Cal Matters reporter Matt Levin has a story.
So you're at Station 1. This is where we actually build the floor of the residential unit.
Larry Pace is giving me a tour of a construction site. Kind of. We're in a 258,000-square-foot factory in Vallejo, on the outskirts of the Bay Area. They used to build submarines here during World War II.
And they build one floor approximately every 2.5 hours. It's fast.
Picture one of those General Motors plants in Detroit, where a car is put together in an assembly line. Except instead of a Buick and a conveyor belt, carpenters in hard hats and goggles are assembling a 156-unit apartment building for a development in Oakland.
Once it goes to Station 2, then we do the mechanical, electrical, and plumbing roughing.
There's a station for cabinets, and a station for roofing, and a station for toilets. All the way through Station 33, which looks like a furniture showroom not quite ready for the floor. Pace is the co-founder of FactoryOS, a modular housing manufacturer that opened this plant last year. They're just one of several companies in California and across the country trying to revolutionize how we make housing.
This particular unit, you're getting a washer-dryer unit, a refrigerator, a range, and a microwave.
That's pretty good. I don't have an in-unit washer-dryer.
Well, you would if you lived here.
Pace has been working in the construction industry for 40 years. He used to do what's called stick construction, the conventional method, where you prep the foundation and then you wait for the carpenters and then the plumbers and then the electricians.
So we believe that without a shadow of a doubt, we can demonstrate there's at least a 20% savings to your overall construction budget.
But the idea of building homes in a factory has been around for a while.
Which brings us to the real problem. Providing housing for that many new people each year. We just haven't been building that much.
That's an infomercial from the Department of Housing and Urban Development from the early 70s. At the time, the Nixon administration was facing problems that might sound eerily familiar to today's Californians.
Needed was a way to eliminate or minimize these constraints to home building. A way to break through them. A new way of doing things. A housing breakthrough.
Alex Anderson is a professor of architecture at the University of Washington.
Operation Breakthrough was really a big and pretty expensive failure and really quite an embarrassment for the Nixon administration.
HUD spent $190 million trying to get private companies to jumpstart factory-built apartments and single-family homes. Much of the housing ended up being uninhabitable after a few years, and Congress pulled the plug pretty quickly. Modular housing technology has improved a lot since the early 70s, but Anderson says issues that confounded Operation Breakthrough still haunt the industry to this day.
There have been all kinds of interesting experiments, but not a lot of economic successes in this part of the market.
FactoryOS is confident this time will be different. For one, the sticker price in these apartments will be market rate, $3,700 for...
So this is a two-bedroom unit.
Jessica Goldbach is the project manager at the first FactoryOS project that's actually standing. We're in that furniture showroom from that last station in the factory, except now it's on the fourth floor in Oakland.
I think what's different about what this is we can make a whole building basically erect in 10 days.
That's how long it took cranes to stack these apartments this summer. Goldbach says that produces economies of scale. You can build thousands of apartments a year, not just single-family homes. Housing experts say in the long run, building housing more quickly will eventually cool California's sizzling housing market. Whether modular housing can turn the long run into a sprint remains an open question. In Oakland, I'm Matt Levin.
You may have noticed there are 1 or 2 million scooters scooting around LA. Okay, so it's not that many. But sometimes, depending on what part of the city you happen to be in, it can feel that way. They're all part of a city pilot program to see how cars, bikes, scooters, and people can coexist together. Coming up, we're going to hear how it's been working out when Take Two continues in 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. LA Unified School officials have been developing a system to give each of its schools a grade, a single overall rating of its academic performance. But the idea has been controversial, and tomorrow the school board could end the project. The district considered the idea because California is one of the rare states that doesn't issue an overall rating to each school. 45 states do, including Indiana, and that's where KPCC's Kyle Stokes was once an education reporter. There, 6 years ago, Kyle covered a scandal that could serve as a parable for LAUSD.
There was a school that everybody in the Indiana Department of Education just loved, Crystal House Academy, a charter school in Indianapolis where a lot of low-income kids went to, quote-unquote, beat the odds. Its test scores were great. But Tom LoBianco, who used to cover Indiana for the Associated Press, says Crystal House also got attention because of who founded it.
Crystal DeHaan was and still is a major political donor. And she was a big financial supporter of the school superintendent, Tony Bennett.
Tony Bennett, not the crooning singer, but Indiana's top elected education official, is the key figure in this story. In 2012, his big project was updating Indiana's school rating system. The state already gave schools A through F letter grades, but Bennett wanted to change how the state calculated them. His team knew that test scores tend to mirror levels of poverty in a school, so they also wanted to give bonus points to schools where students were making big strides year to year. A very similar growth calculation features prominently in LAUSD's proposed model, though the district would give schools star ratings, not letter grades like Indiana did.
In the end, we came up with a model that I thought was pretty good.
Jonathan Plucker, then of Indiana University, was an on and off consultant to Tony Bennett as he tried to balance how much credit to give schools for growth without forgetting the bottom line. Schools should still want kids passing state tests. And initially, Plucker was happy with the model.
Then we turned it over to the Department of Education and the lobbyists got involved.
Which brings us back to Crystal House. Bennett's team was under a lot of pressure from charter school advocates to ensure that charters would look good in the new A through F ratings.
They guaranteed Crystal House, whatever system they put together, Crystal DeHaan's charter school was going to get an A.
Again, that's Tom LoBianco, the former AP reporter, and he knows this because he got a bunch of internal emails from Tony Bennett's team. And behind the scenes, the initial runs of the grading model were not giving Crystal House an A. Crystal House was getting a C.
Tony wrote in his email, he said, oh, this is unacceptable. So they work furiously behind the scenes to recraft the school grading formula to ensure that Crystal House gets an A.
LoBianco's story in 2013 started a scandal. Indiana threw the new rating system out. Bennett had already lost re-election by then, but the story cost him his next job. And to this day, if you believe that grading schools is a bad idea, this story is Exhibit A. On the other hand, a former top aide, Dale Chu, defends Bennett, saying he wasn't manipulating the system. He was fixing it.
Anything lower than an A for Crystal House would just get folks to sort of question sort of the integrity of the system. It was like, yeah, like that can't be right.
Because many people agreed Crystal House was a good school, and I was one of them. Officials often check the new rating system's results against schools thought to be good. And therein is the cautionary tale that I take with me to cover LAUSD's ratings debate. Just because these ratings are fed by objective numbers, school rating systems are not unbiased. They're just systematically applying the same subjective judgment to every school. Now, that doesn't mean that school rating systems are good or bad, but it does mean that the public has to look very carefully at the way ratings are calculated. Covering education, I'm Kyle Stokes.
All right, now let's get on the road. The city of Los Angeles temporarily suspended Uber's permit to rent electric scooters and bikes. LA's transportation department informed the company in a letter last week. Now, the reason Uber resisted handing over its trip data to the city for months. Now, Uber's subsidiary, Jump, has until Friday to appeal. Otherwise, the company needs to pack up its bright red scooters and bikes and get out of town. We're going to be monitoring that. Meanwhile, LADOT has been running the nation's largest experiment in dockless personal mobility with about 38,000 electric scooters and bikes moving around the town. Now, the idea is to get more people out of their cars and to reduce travel emissions, especially for those shorter trips. Now, the city has been running this pilot program for about 6 months, so we thought we'd check in and see how it's working. Salita Reynolds is general manager of LADOT, and I asked her just how many of these personal mobility devices are on the streets.
So it varies, but the day after the 4th of July, we had 52,000 rides in a single day. And if you add it all up, we're averaging enough to hit about 19 million rides in the first year that these things are on the streets.
Now, with any new system, there are always some unintended consequences. And Salida, unless you got a crystal ball in front of you, I don't know if anyone can predict the future. What would you say have been some of the unforeseen downsides to allowing so many scooters in the city?
Well, I think first and foremost, the need for us to have a much smarter way of organizing our sidewalks. And we've been doing our best to try and create parking corrals for people to park these things when they get to where they're going. The last piece, an unforeseen consequence that I hope is a good thing, is that we have a whole new audience and constituency of people who really care deeply about making our streets safer for people no matter how they move around. And we might actually see some new street designs emerge because people want a safer, more protected place to ride these things. And maybe they're not called bike lanes anymore. They're called new mobility lanes or micro mobility lanes or whatever we come up with. But I think you'll see some innovation in the way that we design the streets as well.
One of the things we keep hearing about, though, is emergency room visits when it comes to people maybe having accidents with scooters. How many have been recorded in the last few months and why?
So we have a system of intaking information about crashes that happen on the streets. And what we've seen is that the overall number of scooter crashes is about 2% of the total number of crashes that we see in the city, and severe injury crashes, they account for about 0.5%. We're seeing crashes really track with the number of scooters that are out there. So in the beginning of the program, there weren't that many scooters and there weren't that many crashes, and then as the fleet grew, the number of crashes increased. But on balance, it's still a really small part of the overall pie, and so our focus really has to remain on the biggest cause of crashes out there, which is really happening between people who drive and people who walk.
Now, one of the things I've seen a few times, Salida, is I see someone riding a scooter and I'm thinking, that person does not look old enough to be on that scooter. You kind of giggled there a little bit. Have you heard that as well? And how do you stop that from happening?
Yeah, I've heard that anecdotally. And what we've tried to do is, you know, there is a requirement that people have a driver's license in order to be on a scooter in the state, but LADOT is really not responsible for enforcing rider behavior. And so we look to our partners at LAPD to go out and issue those kinds of moving violations. But what we can do for our part is work closely with the companies to insist that people have to actually scan a driver's license in order to get access to the scooters. But it's a tricky problem because, you know, there's kind of ways around that kind of self-reporting, and we're not sure if we've hit upon the right way to prevent or diminish underage riding the way that we would like to. So I would say that's something we're still working on.
And I guess I got another story to tell you, Salida, just of me driving around the city. In downtown LA one evening, you know how there's a lot of one-way streets? I was making a left turn from the left lane to go north on a street, and I was waiting for someone on a scooter who was crossing the street or was riding across the street. And all of a sudden, right in front of me, he got off the scooter and left it there. So I was like, okay, I guess I'm going around the scooter. Is there any way to deal with that? People just leaving them in the middle of the sidewalk or actually in the middle of the street?
So that is a challenge, not just for people doing something like that, which kind of defies common sense.
I wanted to say something, but I'm trying to be a more, you know, patient driver.
Yes. Well, I appreciate that. As somebody who walks and bikes, I really, really appreciate that. And I would say, you know, it's not just about people leaving them maybe in the middle of the street or the sidewalk, but also leaving them around sensitive areas of the city like the Venice canals, where the lithium batteries in the scooters can actually do tremendous damage to the natural environment in the city. So we have created a way of getting information and data about where the fleets are. So I don't have any idea who is actually on the scooter or how many rides they took or where they live, but I know where the 37,000 scooters are in the city at any given time because of the way that we share information with the scooter companies as regulators. And they actually have a clock that starts that they have to go and remove those scooters when they end up where they're not supposed to. So we have started building that program and really aimed at trying to solve the problem you just articulated, which is we want new transportation choices to succeed in LA. We want them to be safe. And in order to do that, we have to help these companies help themselves by making sure that they operate in a reasonable and sort of organized way. And the best way we have to ensure that is to get information about where the fleet is.
All right, now this LA DOT dockless mobility pilot is supposed to last through next March. What happens then?
So what I'm hoping is that by January or February of next year, we're able to bring back a report to the City Council that begins to make recommendations for how we would make this permanent. And my goal is to have a, you know, if we're seeing this system, it works and people are really using it and we're able to address some of the problems that we saw early on, that we can recommend it being permanent without any break in service for people who might have come to rely on this as a way of getting around town. So we'll see how that all plays out, but that's our goal.
Salita, I'm a little ashamed to admit I have yet to use a scooter in Los Angeles. But
right.
by the next time we talk, Salita, I promise I'll get on one so I'll have the firsthand experience.
Can't wait to hear all about it.
Salita Reynolds, General Manager of the LA Department of Transportation, which is running the country's largest dockless mobility program. Salita, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Speaking of e-scooters, if you're traveling in downtown LA or certain parts of Glendale and Santa Monica, you might notice a different kind of UPS delivery vehicle, a scooter carrying a 6-foot trailer. KPCC's Sue Carpenter has that story.
Think UPS and those brown traffic-clogging trucks probably come to mind. But now, the world's largest parcel delivery company is thinking small.
These are our patented foldable cargo trailers.
Peter Lee is co-founder of Urby, a Pasadena company. It started out making electric scooters that fold up when they're not being used. And now, they've got a tow hitch for a trailer that can haul 350 pounds of packages and then collapse to the size of a carry-on bag.
Some of them will be deployed directly from the warehouse. Some of them will deploy from the truck in an area.
From there, they will travel in bike lanes where available or on the side of the street, like a bicycle. And in crowded cities, that makes deliveries faster, says Alina Reynolds, general manager of the Los Angeles Department of Transportation.
In the time it takes a regular truck to sort of maneuver through city traffic and double park, et cetera, the smaller, lighter vehicle has already been there and gone.
She says several other cities have already shifted to this kind of small-scale package delivery and that such a system for LA is long overdue. I'm Sue Carpenter.
I remember when my daughter was 7, we went to the supermarket to buy groceries, and out of the blue, she asked me what happens to all those fruits and vegetables if no one buys them all. She caught me off guard, and I said they'd probably throw them away. My 6-year-old granddaughter, a few decades later, and I were in the supermarket, and she asked me the same question. And I gave her the same answer. In a state that makes so much food combined with so many people dealing with food insecurity, it's not great to know how much food actually winds up as trash. Coming up now, food in the ground, how it stays there instead of going into the mouths of people who need it. That's next on Take Two. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. A recent statewide study from Santa Clara University found that a third of hand-picked crops in California are left to rot. Farmers say the loss is a financial necessity, the result of the high cost of labor and low prices for produce. But while super-producing agricultural hubs, just like Fresno, grow crops to spare, many residents in these communities don't get enough nutritious food to eat. Greg Baker is executive director of the Center for Food Innovation and Entrepreneurship at Santa Clara University. He led that study. Professor, welcome to Take Two.
Glad to be here.
Now, you surveyed farms for 2 years to look at crop loss. How did you conduct the study, and what types of farms and crops were you looking at?
So we started with hand-harvested crops as compared to machine-harvested crops. And we would go into the fields. We'd work with the field managers, and they would direct us to an area of the field that they thought was representative. And we would typically do something like 4 to 12 rows, ranging from 25 to 100 feet long. We used student researchers who were trained so that we could be very precise in our measurement of the crops that were left behind.
Yeah, I was thinking how meticulous that sounds, Greg. How was your method different from previous surveys?
Well, the basic difference was there were very few surveys. Almost everything that had been published was based on estimates. And what we found with our study was that growers themselves actually didn't know how much was left in the fields. We found that the actual results were 257% of what they thought was left behind. So what we believe is that the estimates actually, you know, grossly underreported what was left unharvested.
What's the difference between crop loss and waste? I would figure if it's left behind, it's waste too.
We don't consider it waste because it is left in the field and it's plowed back in. So you're increasing the organic matter in the field. So if you were to actually harvest this and pack it and then ship it to a warehouse, for example, and then it were to be thrown away, it would likely go into a landfill. So you have a lot more labor and materials, as well as fossil fuels, that are going to go to move it to a warehouse. So we call it loss because it actually is of value to the farmers because they're enriching their fields.
Now, Greg, when you talk to the growers, the farmers, how do they explain the loss?
Well, we found that, and we did ask growers why the crops were not harvested. And some of the time it was cosmetic reasons. Sometimes it's maybe too small. And the growers are growing to contract. So they will typically overplant so that they can make sure that they have enough quantity and the right quality. And at that point, they have to consider what is the cost of getting out of the field and what is the benefit to them. Virtually every grower indicated that labor is in short supply, and so oftentimes they are not going to be able to generate enough revenue from harvesting and packing the crop to actually pay their labor and all the costs that are involved.
Let's turn now to Manuela Tobias, a reporter with the Fresno Bee who's been covering the story. Manuela, welcome to Take Two.
Hi, thank you.
Now, at the same time these crops are rotting, there are huge rates of food insecurity all throughout California. What's the scope of food insecurities, particularly in Fresno?
Yeah, throughout California, the USDA found in 2018 that about 10.4% of people are food insecure. But in Fresno, it's over double that rate. It's 22%. That's the third highest rate in the country. That's particularly concerning because Fresno is also the number one ag producer in the country. Many of the people who are facing food insecurity are the laborers who are working to harvest and pack these crops.
Yeah, tell us about the mother and former farm worker who really struggles to afford food for her family. What did she tell you about her life?
Yeah, so I spoke with a woman called Maximina Molina Sanchez. Her situation is basically that she has two small children. One of them is 9 months old. Her husband is currently unemployed because he used to work as a lettuce packer, but he injured his back from a work-related accident. So they rely on the local food bank.
Talking with Manuela Tobias, a reporter with the Fresno Bee, and Greg Baker, executive director of the Center for Food Innovation and Entrepreneurship at Santa Clara University. Back to you, Professor Baker, for a second. You've talked to these growers. Can they just donate the food to people who need it and maybe get a tax credit for it? I know you mentioned that the labor sometimes can get a little cost prohibitive, but is that an option at all?
Absolutely. And California has recently revised the tax credit so that it's easier to implement and easier for growers to use. But what we found is that many growers either don't know about the tax incentives or they're too complicated to use.
Is there any maybe support to other programs to help with the fields at all? Is there anything other than just maybe devoting resources from the farms themselves? Any other programs at all?
Sure. That is the next step of the study for those of us who are working at food loss at the farm level. And, you know, they're certainly not planting the crops to just leave them in the fields to be plowed under. So several of the things we're looking at is the possibility of apps that would try to help match available trained labor with growers who need labor. We're looking at the possibility of retailers purchasing entire fields because we feel like, you know, then it's up to them. Once it's harvested, you know, maybe they can have imperfect produce alongside cosmetically perfect produce in their grocery stores. Maybe it'll be juiced, maybe it'll be dehydrated, but somehow or another, we can make better use of what's produced.
What about programs to glean the fields?
One of the issues that we find is many of the crops are harvested multiple times. And because of the need to train the laborers who work in the fields, it's probably not practical for crops that are harvested multiple times because of food safety concerns.
Manuela Tobias with the Fresno Bee. If say, a food bank or there were volunteers that wanted to go out and get those leftover crops, could they go do it?
Yeah, so I spoke with one of the farms here. This farmer described an effort by a local food bank to organize folks, and only two people actually showed up, and one of them was one of the farm employees, and they only picked about one bin of cantaloupes. So it kind of describes how much of an organizational effort it is to get people out there. And then there's also just the legal liability. That's another cost that many growers just can't really afford.
One more thing for you, Professor Baker. I know that there's been resources spent to try and figure out ways to get this food out of the ground and into the hands of people who are hungry. Is it going to take more than just resources? Is it going to take some kind of maybe political will or just everyone getting together and saying, look, this can't be left in the ground?
I think we need to work on streamlining the process, ensuring that the growers don't feel like they're at risk. So I think trying to make sure that that we have good communication with the tax incentives and making sure that our Good Samaritan laws protect them not only from food safety liability should someone get sick, but also that they're going to be legally protected should somebody, a gleaner in the field, trip and hurt themselves, that they're also going to be protected from that type of liability.
Greg Baker is Executive Director of the Center for Food Innovation and Entrepreneurship at Santa Clara University. Manuela Tobias, a reporter with the Fresno Bee. My thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Yes.
For many people, getting a pair of sneakers is only about putting shoes on feet. Now, that makes total sense because at its most basic level, that is what they are for. However, for others, there's a lot more involved when you buy a pair of sneakers. For these folks, both young and old, it's about art, it's about style, it's about cultural relevance, it's about investing in social acceptance. I will never, ever, ever forget being the first kid in my high school with Air Jordans. My coolness rating went from a zero. Well, only till about a two, but at least it went up. Coming up, a new pop-up art installation tells you all about that. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. I am a huge sneakerhead. My first pair of sneaks that I really, really treasured were classic red, white, and black Nike Air Jordan 1. That shoe first came out in 1984, and it was the brand that sparked sneaker culture for generations. Now, since then, I've worn and collected several dozen pairs, from Magic Johnson's Converse Weapons to the inflatable Reebok Pump. You remember those? And there are tons of other sneakerheads in LA right here, just like me. Now, you can find many of them lining up early in the morning, waiting to snag latest styles from stores like Supreme and Flight Club on Fairfax Avenue. So when I heard that there was a new pop-up museum filled with art pieces dedicated to sneaker culture, I had to go. It's called Sneakertopia in West LA. And to prepare for the visit, I slipped on my pearl white Nike Air Force Ones and met up with the creator, Justin Fredericks.
Hey yo, who wear it all? I'm a Adidas freak, multi-thousand pair sneak freak, real fly physique.
So Justin, right off the bat, if anyone has ever bought a pair of new sneakers, they know what it smells like. That's what it smells like in here as we just walk in.
Yeah, you kind of step into a shoebox, right?
Yeah.
Okay, it kind of has that smell to it.
Yeah. And right off the bat, what are we seeing here?
Yeah, so this first area, it's basically this complete immersive sneaker culture mural that's in kind of a form of a storybook. Kind of these sketches from the early days of sneaker culture, from Dossler developing the first Adidas, the first Chuck Taylors in the 1920s, and we kind of goes all the way to the future where Nikes are being delivered by drones. And the key kind of...
I can't wait for that.
Yeah, right?
Always keep it real with the selection. Holding you, Prince, Black Jordans, K-Swiss kid, remember Lotto's, Stash Man...
All right, so what are we looking at now?
Right, so we've now just stepped into the playground, which are these street court installations. So the first step into mural is a 16-foot Serena and off-white tennis court.
Serena Williams, the tennis star.
And off-white tennis court. So Serena Williams has partnered with Virgil Abloh and Off-White to design not only her sneakers, but a lot of her tennis outfits. You can literally step into a court, and then you see Serena basically posterizing you with her serve. It's like the tennis version of getting dunked on.
Because right next to Serena Williams is Michael Jordan, who is...
Right.
In the mode of posterizing someone else with a dunk.
Exactly. So we have a Michael Jordan basketball court, which is a 16-foot mural of Michael Jordan, who's dunking onto this pillar. And then you can actually step into the Michael Jordan basketball court in the classic red, black, and white colorways. Both the Serena and the Jordan murals were designed by this brilliant, both studio and street artist, James Hunt. So along the Jordan mural, we have some of the most popular or rare Jordans in the evolution of the shoe. Exactly. And then you have also next to the Serena Off-White mural, all of the Off-Whites that have been released, including the two Serena Off-Whites.
Let me ask you something, because, okay, so you mentioned this is a playground kind of setting, and that is exactly when any kid buys his new sneakers. That's where you go show them off.
Yes.
Typically, what kind of kid, what kind of person is into sneakers more than someone else?
Some are more into it than others, where it's, you have this distinction between being into sneakers and showing off your personality through the shoes you're wearing. And then at a young age, you have some kids who already start their career of collecting sneakers. And, you know, there's this saying, you know, if you can afford it, you buy one to rock and one to stock. So one to wear on the courts and one to actually stock and hold, because now they're also this form of art and an investment. So if you hold on to them long enough, you'll be able to actually resell them.
When it comes to sneaker culture, what does that mean in LA?
Sports, music, film, design, fashion, all those creative fields, LA is the capital for that. Sneakers are fueled through all these other cultures. That makes LA such a great place to start the exhibit.
Inside Los Angeles, where is the hub of sneaker culture in LA? What area?
Yeah, so it's definitely Fairfax, right? So
okay.
Fairfax, you have Undefeated, but then you have the lines outside of Supreme every Thursday morning at 8 a.m. because they have their drop offline and online. So all the kind of hottest, newest, both street and sneaker brands pop up on Fairfax.
All right, let's keep going.
Yeah. My Adidas walk through closet doors. So now we step into the largest footprint of the exhibit.
Wow.
It's called The Festival. And this is dedicated to music influence on sneaker culture. It feels like an outdoor music festival with fake grass lining the entire space. And it's flanked by three stages that are built to look like massive shoeboxes. The main stage is the Adidas stage that is painted like an Adidas superstar shoebox, with a projected mural that goes on the wall that kind of visually narrates the story that starts with Run DMC, who I guess literally and figuratively set the stage for other musicians to collaborate with the sneaker concert.
Really, rappers rapping about my Adidas.
Exactly,
yeah.
So they were really well known for, that's how, you know, Adidas and sneaker culture got on the map in the music world, because Run DMC had a major concert in Madison Square Garden, and during their famous song, My Adidas, encouraged the thousands of audience members to hold up their Adidas. And there was a scene where thousands of the guests were holding up their Adidas superstars in the air, and that really puts them on the map. And since then, you know, Pharrell and now Beyonce are partnering with Adidas. So this mural is designed to honor them. And all the murals in this music festival area were designed by a great LA street artist, Man One.
Now that rappers and singers have gotten into this game, what kind of an impact has that made?
It's a huge impact. I mean, so the format is the sneaker company partners with a major musician like Kanye and his Yeezys, and then the release is in limited edition format, so there's always a greater, you know, demand than there is a supply of the sneaker release, and then that creates a whole secondary market for sneakers. So literally the morning of, you can have a Yeezy released, and an hour later they're double or triple the price on these secondary markets. And then you have some just really rare sneakers, which were super, super limited, right? So here we have the M&M 4s. So this is a collaboration between, you know, Jordan and M&M. I think there were only about 10 to 20 released. This is this one pair. This is a $25,000 pair of sneakers.
Wow.
Yeah.
So these rare ones, the ones we're looking at now, where did you get them?
Yeah, so it's great. We have a partnership with one of the biggest sneaker collectors in the world. He owns 25,000 pairs of sneakers. He's remaining anonymous right now, but he's been generous enough to allow us to showcase 200 pairs of sneakers at a time, and we can continuously refresh them and switch them out. The other great thing is they're both for display and for sale.
Now, for a lot of people, though, Justin, I mean, these are just shoes. How do you argue that it's something more than that, maybe an art form, wearable art?
What we think is really powerful about the sneaker is that it's very inspirational and aspirational, in the sense that literally kids who are growing up, you know, going to elementary school and middle school, they can literally wear the same sneakers as their heroes. They can wear the same sneakers that LeBron's wearing on the court. They can wear the same sneakers that Beyonce is wearing on the stage. And then for, you know, the demographic of guests who grew up in the 80s, let's say, who, you know, during the, you know, boom or birth of sneaker culture, it's very nostalgic. So it's kind of looking backwards on your life, remembering the first Jordans you had, or the first time the Reebok pumps came out and you could actually tighten your shoes by pumping on the tongue.
All right, let's keep going.
Yeah. So this we're calling the Dream Room. So the highlight piece here is this chandelier-like sculpture designed by Michael Murphy. He's calling it Air, and it's a suspended Jordan 1 sneaker in the classic red, black, and white colorways. From one angle, you see the Jordan 1, and as we walk around the arc, it transforms into Jordan and Jumpman himself.
Oh, the Jumpman logo. That's
the
Michael
Jumpman
Jordan's
logo.
That particular shoe, that cemented sneakers as the thing that people need to have,
yeah,
didn't it?
Definitely. If you ask most adults today what's their first memory with sneakers, it's either the Jordan 1 or one of the Jordans. To this day, he's still the biggest influential kind of individual and now brand with the Jordan brand in the culture. Yeah.
What's the holy grail of sneakers? Is there a pair?
I think that changes for each different individual. For me personally, for example, my first deep experience and memory with the sneakers was the Reebok Pump. And the Reebok Pump isn't like a collector shoe or an investment shoe, but I was always fascinated about the intersection between technology and sneakers. And so when I was in, I think, elementary school, and the Reebok Pumps got released, and I was like, wow, I could actually tighten my shoes by pressing on the tongue, I was obsessed with that, to the point where I wore those Reebok Pumps down to basically their last thread and still wanted to preserve the technology. So I cut the tongue and the pump out of that shoe and tried to insert it in every other shoe that I had since then. It didn't work. I wasn't a great inventor, but it just shows like that my connection to that specific shoe and technology.
That's Justin Fredericks, head of curation and partnerships at Sneakertopia. You can come visit here at Sneakertopia all the way through early next year. Justin, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
If you are all-star, lace up your all-stars and keep it G and post up in your all-stars.
If you missed any part of the show today, just head over to wherever you get your podcast. Look for us, Take 2. There we will be waiting to be heard by you. I'm going to put up pictures of my trip to Sneakertopia on my Instagram. It's at amartinezla. That's at amartinezla. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take 2. We'll be back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.